The name Weimar Republic comes from the fact that a constitution is written in the city of Weimar, not in war-torn Berlin, but in this blessed, culturally gifted spot of Weimar. The key question is economic volatility. Hyperinflation in 1923, and then Germany's experience of the worldwide Great Depression in the early 1930s. Those things conspire to undermine German confidence in democracy. The Nazis in January of 1933 do not overthrow a functioning, vigorous democracy. The entire system was losing legitimacy in the eyes of ordinary Germans. The Nazis exploit a crisis that was pre-existing. They do gain greater and greater support among German voters, but their vote share is actually declining in elections at the point when Hitler manages to be appointed as chancellor.
I'd love to talk about how you see the role that Rome and Greece and then the Enlightenment have played in America, the country that you and I live in, and the world that we see in general. You can take that and run with it and take as much time as you would like to try to address those subjects.
Well, Dan, you're far too kind in attributing expertise to historians. My own research interests are in modern European history.
Yeah.
But even when I'm teaching the survey classes here at University of Tennessee to undergraduates, we start by talking about the legacy of the classical period and ancient Rome and ancient Greece. And a few years ago, I finally hit, I think, on the best way of explaining this to undergraduates, which is that ancient Greece and ancient Rome, imperfectly understood as they were in centuries afterwards, continue to haunt our imagination. They continue to be foundational for the civilization that we take part in. And in many ways, it's a humbling kind of presence in our own civilization because such achievements, such greatness, such concentrated, especially in the case of Athens, such concentrated personalities who are thinking and in dialogue with one another, that kind of sets the standard centuries ago for what, you know, how we define cultural excellence and greatness and what it is that we aspire to. And when I talk about this in a Western Civ class, I'll prove for them that we're haunted by these examples by putting up photographs on PowerPoint of Washington, D.C., and the architecture, which is in imitation of classical Greek and classic Roman models. So it is an abiding presence in any kind of intellectual discussion of what Western civilization represents or world civilization represents today. It's been observed, for instance, that when you study philosophy, so much of philosophy is a footnote to Plato. Elaborations on, you know, a classical body of thought already so many centuries old, but it's not limited to Plato. Even when you're looking at the transition to the early modern period, you see thinkers who are engaged in their own dialogue across centuries with the legacies of ancient Greece and ancient Rome. And there are, you know, there's many examples of this. But I think one that's experiencing a revival today is a renewed appreciation of Stoic thought. And, you know, on your website where you have some of your favorite quotes, a lot of those quotes, I think, are kind of, they're not exclusively Stoic, but a lot of them share in the wisdom of the Stoics, a sense that self-mastery and restraint is the path to real happiness and real meaning. And I think, in fact, you've probably even had an interview with an expert on Stoic thought. One of the books that really excited me when I was an undergraduate and starting to think about graduate school was by a scholar named Gerhard Oestreich on Neo-Stoicism, the way in which early modern thinkers about politics and culture and how to organize a state were excited to rediscover the classic legacy of thinkers like Marcus Aurelius and others And they made them their own. Now, that doesn't mean that they understood them perfectly or that they understood them even in the same ways. But what an astonishing drama there is to a conversation that takes place with people who are dead centuries ago and yet are still engaging our imaginations. So this is the reason why I think that there's renewed interest in the classics, in going back to the sources, opening wide how we define the sources that represent the best in the past, and engaging with them actively. In a way, that's kind of in counterpoint with a lot of trends that we unfortunately see in culture and even in academia at the present moment. And in counterpoint and intention, there's a much discussed article from The Atlantic magazine right now about how even at elite colleges, students are less and less being asked to read entire books. Instead, they're being offered anthologies or excerpts. And obviously, it's better to read something in an anthology or an excerpt than not to engage with it at all. But to really, really engage in a full sense with the texts that are foundational, you need to acquire that patience and that ability to concentrate that really marks a true education. And so I think that that's something that this present generation will have to hash out. And then you asked about the age and the Enlightenment. I think that it's fascinating to teach the Enlightenment or to try to, because there's even debate about how to define that thing. Mm. In a graduate seminar that took place just down the hallway earlier this week, students and I were discussing how historians today see the Enlightenment in such variegated terms that we often find ourselves adding an S on the end and talking about enlightenments in the plural, talking about a radical enlightenment, a more moderate enlightenment, talking about a Spanish enlightenment, a German enlightenment, a Catholic enlightenment versus a secularizing enlightenment or deist enlightenment. So all of this is very variegated, but it's a good place to start surveys in modern history for undergraduates, because two things happen. On the one hand, you can present to them and communicate the excitement that ideas can carry. I mean, the way your podcast does. Students may be familiar with survey courses where it's a dreary trudge through. First, there was this school of philosophy, then that school of philosophy. When you get to the Enlightenment, however, there's a kind of electric charge in the sense of mission that Enlightenment thinkers had. You know, by golly, they thought they were going to transform the world by the application of reason and do things that that earlier generations had not managed to pull off. And then you can introduce students to the even more outrageous reality that some Enlightenment thinkers were so optimistic about human nature and its possibilities that they imagined that it might be readily possible quite soon to achieve total perfection. I know that's breathtaking, right? Because, I mean, chastened as we are about our appreciation for technology and some of its downsides, some of its dangers, it sets us apart from these first Enlightenment philosophers and thinkers who envisioned that that all problems are susceptible to being conquered and overcome and transcended through the use of reason and science and rationality. That's one thing that happens for students. The other thing is when you start reading out to them a catalog or a shopping list of key Enlightenment values, and you get to political values like life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, suddenly there's a resonance. They understand from their American background that the United States, among other things, was envisioned as an Enlightenment project and defined in those terms, drawing heavily on these modes of thinking. And so there's the newness and there's a sense of recognition that this is going to be something that's not an inquiry where the stakes are abstract, mundane, of little relevance. They couldn't be more relevant because they tell us who we are and the project that we're collectively engaged in. So that's tremendously satisfying. But then let me do what historians love to do most, which is just to complicate things and to add ever new levels of complexity. And the key thing, of course, is not to just walk away after having achieved that. You have to try to leave people confused at a higher level, you might say. That's the way you posed the question to begin with. What about the Enlightenment's role in creating the modern world? And that's where we get to a really vexed set of problems, ones that have troubled me ever since I got launched in the study of history. And that is, what do we mean when we talk about modernity? Who's modernity? What are the constituent elements of modernity? This is one of those terms that we use all the time without defining carefully. And I wish I had an answer to this. The best one can do, I think, is to start gathering elements that people bring up when they talk about modernity and see which ones are in conflict, which ones match. Some definitions of modernity talk about a new role for the individual, a new role for critical thought, reasoned thought, rather than thought that's dependent upon traditions or superstitions or revelations. There are some who identify modernity with an increasing secularization. But historians have long been uneasy about what got called in the 1970s the secularization thesis. The world around us sees religious belief and belief in revelation still very strong, and in some parts of the world growing, right? So some of these elements are contested. There's urbanization. There's the modern state and modern bureaucracy and the state's ability to intervene in ways that are unprecedented in ordinary people's lives, whether for good or for ill. What you mentioned at the outset, the role of ideologies, all of these things come together to offer maybe building blocks to discuss modernity. But the cruel joke in all of this is that modernity just means the here and now, the way things are now, which on the one hand tends to say, cut us off from the past and those elements that brought us to where we are. But the problem is when you're cut off, you're unable to see where it is that you're proceeding and to get a sense of the bigger picture. So I think that that's going to be an ongoing project to try to become ever more precise in our definitions of modernity, a term that we otherwise use with so much ease.
I would love to give the audience too some additional context as to the inheritance. This is mostly directed towards Western countries. And I think you said earlier in the conversation that you teach about Western European civilization. If we could give a little bit of space to contrast the revolutionary ideas of the Enlightenment to what else was going on in the world at that time. I know from the very little I'm aware of European history prior to the Enlightenment, the absolute monarch phenomenon was very common. Individual liberties were not particularly well codified into law, if at all. If we could spend a little time, and if there's any link that you see to the revolutionary ideas of the Enlightenment to Greece and Rome or other areas of history, feel free to add anything that you think might be of interest to the audience there.
Yeah, exactly. So, I should point out, as you mentioned a moment ago as well, that I'm a historian of Europe. So my comments deal with the Western experience most of all. And yet, I think that the area of politics is an especially good way to talk about contrasts. And at this very moment at University of Tennessee, I'm teaching a really fun class about the history of European monarchies and how we go from Charlemagne as the emperor of a reconstituted Holy Roman Empire in the year 800 to today, with King Charles III as one of the surviving monarchs of an institution that used to be going so strong, but has its fortunes have changed radically, right? Mm. And the textbook that we use for this class is one that your readers might find really admirable. It's a beautifully written book by a historian from the University of North Carolina at Asheville, Spelman, and it's entitled Monarchies. And it looks at world monarchies. So it's very ambitious in scope. And the author does a really good job of pointing out that monarchies are institutions that long, long predate democracy, a system that we see as normative, that indeed around the world today, even despotic regimes want to call themselves democracies. So there's a sense that that's a default mode or especially admirable or especially natural. That's historically very recent in terms of such a perspective. And what Spelman does really well in his book is to emphasize that while monarchy has been universal, it usually has involved radical and, as you said, absolutist claims of control over religion, over society, over mobilizing resources in different societies, and that the exception historically is the experience of European monarchies, which by contrast were, even when they did claim absolute power, tended to be less effective, less centralized, a whole lot less impressive, in fact, than many non-Western regimes. Consider the emperors of China or the Inca and Aztec empires in the Americas, or the monarchies of lands in Africa. So again and again, rather than the European case being held up as normative and the one that everyone else has to meet, Spelman shows clearly that it's the exception, and that requires explanation. And I think that the reason that, even though I'm a cultural historian rather than a political historian, this political story is a vital one to understand where we've arrived at today. Indeed, how something like small r Republican or small d Democratic models become normative and so influential in our own times. And that has to do with the decentralization of power in the European context. European history is the story of one battle royale after another. It is a constant contest with claimants for overweening supremacy and constant resistance against that. And these contests have taken many different forms. They've been military. So when France in the modern period and then later Germany threatened to achieve hegemony on the European continent, there tend to be coalitions that rise up against them in order to stop that. Economically, when great trading powers like the Dutch and then later the British rise up, well, there's a contest for economic influence and power as well. In the religious realm, there are claims made by the Roman Catholic Church, the Pope in Rome, for supremacy, and then tremendous clashes in the Reformation, the Counter-Reformation, the religious wars that really do much to shape the contours of European history. And it's those contests, those competitions, and it has to be said, frankly, that sheer violence that produces many of the key elements that are in place even before the Enlightenment really gets going. Thinkers who were scandalized by the notion that people of the same religious faith, Christians versus Christians, whether they were Protestants or Catholics or Orthodox or whatever denomination, were slaughtering one another in the religious wars of Europe over questions of doctrine. This leads to both a scandal and a sense of impatience and an elevation of monarchical authority with absolutist claims as a way of finally moving beyond religious conflict. You see this in the early modern period. This is one element of other streams of thinking that start challenging an earlier sort of pre-modern conception of how politics should be organized and to whose benefit it should be organized, right? Claims of some absolutist monarchs that they rule not for the good of their people, but because of divine right. The claim that God ordained them to be the sole legitimate rulers, that's one ideological explanation. Another ideological explanation is when you have notions that, in fact, monarchies are useful institutions that should rule for the good of the people, and in that way can win the consent of the governed, to use the words of John Locke, an Enlightenment thinker in the British context, and thus make room for consultation with parliaments or with representatives of the population at large, moving towards the model of a constitutional monarchy. So all of these elements playing out with huge drama over centuries, I think, contribute to the context where Enlightenment ideas for rewriting or redesigning become tremendously influential and very attractive. They can also have dangers. The notion that everything can be up for grabs can produce radical, unworkable utopian solutions. And this is the tragic drama of the French Revolution, in which revolutionaries see themselves as given this amazing opportunity to write a new constitution, to create for France an ideal political order. And for reasons that are still being debated by historians today, the revolution, which starts with such hopes and with such ideals of liberty, equality, and fraternity, devolves into massive bloodletting. Mm. And indeed a situation where some of the initial proponents of the revolution end up going to the guillotine as insufficiently radical, insufficiently revolutionary for some of their former comrades. There's a cautionary tale there, and how to work through both the promise and the cautionary side, the dangers, that's in part the ideological history of the 19th century, with different responses by different people. How do you make it work? How do you avoid getting off the rails?
Hmm. This may be a just too straightforward of a question, but in your judgment as a human and as a historian, is there on balance in your mind a quote unquote best system compared to all the others? I wanted to spend a little bit of time too talking about the American Revolution in whatever detail you might like, and the American Democratic Republic. Is there something special about that experiment working in your mind that would lead you to a conclusion that is compared to all of the barbarism and tyranny of historical Europe and the history of the world, is something worth being proud of and worth really taking note of that inheritance? I just want to put that to you and give you any time you might have, given your vast historical knowledge about the American experiment and what you think about it, given all of its flaws, but also potentially the miraculousness of its success.
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I think that if there's an ideal system, it's not one that that humans are necessarily well positioned to engineer. Hmm. When with students we're examining monarchy as a category, I say to students that in general, we're looking at the past. We're bracketing off our own individual politics, right? What we want to understand is, why would people believe some of the things that they did in the past? Like, what's the internal logic? How does that make sense? Because people in the past, contrary to a lot of popular opinion, were not stupid. Yeah. They were essentially like us. They were people doing the best they could under difficult circumstances, but their thinking could be radically different than ours. And so what's required is an act of historical imagination to think your way back into even mindsets that you find kind of repellent or outrageous or unworthy, but to be able to think your way into those categories of the past. But I point out to students, kind of taking a break from that historicism, that even though we're going to spend a whole semester looking at monarchy, I'm not a monarchist. On the contrary, I think that it's fascinating how many ideas have adhered to monarchy, and what is really dramatic and deserving of you know, fascinated or horrified attention is what it means for societies to load so much responsibility and power onto one person, right? A king or a queen, and then to say, okay, now you're responsible for everything. That's fascinating. But I think that on the contrary, in my heart of hearts, the project of a republic, of people ruling themselves, of dialogue and debate, producing policies that we can agree upon and then reform or change, adjust, that is, there's a kind of dignity to that and a kind of self-respect that adheres to that, that I think even the most impressive tyrannies or, you know, a glorious sun king like Louis XIV of France can't match. That said, the democratic process is not one that's always dignified, right? It involves very vigorous debate. That debate also can become, envenomed by passions where we don't find common ground, and that's tragic as well. But I think that the juxtaposition of the American experiment, an American revolution, and a French revolution is so interesting because, in part, many of the ideas that are circulating at the time are in fact linked and are shared, and yet they got taken in very different directions. The results were really dramatic. When I'm here at the University of Tennessee, I point out to students when we're talking about the Reign of Terror and the French Revolution, I say, what's happening in 1793 right here in East Tennessee in the foothills of the Smokies? Well, at that point, the university that's going to become the University of Tennessee is being founded. So it's a very different trajectory. And I think that there's obviously lots of factors at play there. It's a question in part of which elements of the Enlightenment one chooses to emphasize or one chooses to try to put into effect. I try as often as possible in history classes to have students engage with texts that changed world history. And Thomas Paine's Common Sense from 1776 is maybe even the Platonic ideal. It's a tiny little pamphlet, and yet it changed world history because it passed from hand to hand among American colonists. And it was really quite outrageous because it was a newly arrived British Enlightenment thinker, Thomas Paine, who no sooner than he'd arrived, started telling Americans, you are a people that's different from the British. And he even started talking about we Americans, even though he was newly arrived. And he says, you have the ability to begin the world anew in order to break with traditions of monarchy or of deferential aristocratic rule, and instead to constitute yourself on a new continental basis. Thomas Paine, thus, is a pivotal figure in the American case. And without him, the course of the revolution could have run very differently because of the power of his ideas. He gets so excited about the French Revolution when it breaks out that he actually immigrates to France in order to be there, to see yet again, for the second time, a world being created anew. And yet he finds himself out of sympathy with the violence, the kind of elemental hatreds that are unleashed in the radicalizing politics of the French Revolution as they develop, as they evolve. And so this man, who's a foe of monarchy, gets himself into trouble in French politics by pleading for the life of Louis XVI, saying the king, even though the king was representative of a bad regime, he shouldn't be executed. And thus he comes to be suspected of not being sufficiently revolutionary. And his life is almost forfeit as a result of the campaign of guillotining, and yet he's saved at the last moment. So Thomas Paine experienced just how different Enlightenment projects could be in terms of which values they stressed. I think also another example, Alexis de Tocqueville, a brilliant young French social scientist, traveled in the United States to see the democracy as it was forming, and he was fascinated by what he saw because he was sure it was the wave of the future. The rest of the world would move along American paths. But he was also a very keen, insightful student of the French Revolution that had affected his own family, his homeland. And one contrast that emerges is that Tocqueville sees the centralizing impulses of the French state, whether it's monarchical or whether it's a radical French revolutionary state, as part of the answer to the sheer destructiveness and the human toll that's incomparably greater in the more radical French Revolution. So those are at least elements of an answer for contrasts and similarities.
Fascinating. And if you wouldn't mind spending a little time on what you know about what de Tocqueville found, what his big reflections were, what his conclusions were about the early America, I'd love to have that, because I don't think he's such a fascinating figure to me in the little I know about him. And when he wrote his brilliant observations about the early experiment in the United States of America, I want to put that to you and give you any time you'd like to speak about what the big ideas, the big observations were that he made.
Well, I think that what left such an, I should say, first of all, I'm by no means an expert on Tocqueville, so there's many better people to consult on this score. What strikes me and students when we look at the text together is how paradigmatic moments in his travels left big impressions on him. So seeing New England and its tradition of local government, decentralized, very, very regional local government, or you could call it direct democracy, left a big impression on him. The notion that people were taking responsibility for holding office, a kind of practice of civic virtue, and also just the sheer exhaustion of that enterprise, right? Because to be involved in self-government in that way is not something you can delegate to others, right? You would need to offer up time and resources in order to make that happen. Another thing that left a big impression on him was the American commitment to notions of equality. And for him, from a French aristocrat background, this was especially striking. And Tocqueville, I think, is such a restless thinker, trying to do what historians are warned never to do, which is try to understand, well, what are the trend lines? What are the movements of the age that are going to be especially fateful or represent the likely path of development? And so for him, then, I think that equality represented a value that you could see how central it was to the American experiment, and yet raised serious questions. When equality is emphasized, where does that leave questions of excellence? Where does that leave questions of people who are outside of the norm? Does equality mean conformity to the stereotypes or the accepted behaviors? Or is there a tolerance for eccentricity? Is there a tolerance for people thinking independently? I think that both in the case of the young United States, which he saw as blazing the way that all other societies were going to move along as their politics evolved and changed, and then also his own home country of France, left him with these big questions about the future. And I think for that reason, his sort of questing character makes him especially rewarding to read. And there's another example of a book that's that thick, Democracy in America, and needs to be engaged with, not just in excerpts, right?
Yeah, fair enough. And I'm so glad you mentioned this earlier about how I think you said that you ask your students to have, I think the word you used was imagination for what an earlier different era was like for the people who lived in it. And this has just become more of a pet interest of mine in the last few months, but getting more informed about the Weimar Republic in Germany. And I want to have a conversation about the rise of dictatorship and Nazism. And I think what has always struck me and terrified me about that story is the movement from more or less a republic into one of the most destructive and murderous dictatorships in history. And that I would, not sure if you agree with this, but I would have to imagine that when people were acquiescing to that transition or watching that change happen in their own country, they probably didn't expect that this would be the most shameful 5 to 10 year period in their country's history, and didn't really know what they were getting themselves into. And that's always stuck with me as a lesson for us and a lesson for people in general to be a bit more humble about what they're maybe summoning with some of the preferences that may be emerging on a political or cultural scene. I want to set the stage for the audience to give you as much time as you would like to talk about what the Weimar Republic was. I know the Reichstag fire is an important point in the story of the rise of Hitler and the rise of Nazism. But again, this is a massive subject, but I would love to give you space to detail to a general audience what you think matters about the post-World War I Germany, their experiment with their own republic, and then the rise of this, you know, former painter, former World War I soldier, a sort of no-name character who has become synonymous with, I think, in a modern public's imagination, with evil. I want to put that to you and give you as much time as you would like to tell that story as you see it.
Well, Dan, the hours wouldn't suffice to tell it all. But in really, you know, in really broad strokes, the reason this cautionary tale is so gripping is that this was Germany's interwar experiment with democracy. And I'll do something that historians often do, which is probably really irritating to non-historians, which is just to keep tugging back and to say there's a past, there's a prior context that comes into play. And the prior context is the huge dislocations of the First World War.
Yeah.
The First World War has been described as Western civilization's suicide attempt, or a European civil war. And I think that generations from now, hundreds of years from now, people are likely in the future to see the First World War and the Second World War as episodes, not identical, but episodes in one larger, all-consuming conflict that showed that there were real problems and internal explosive conflicts right at the heart of Western civilization. Indeed, I've done a recorded lecture course for the Great Courses in 36 lectures in full detail with all of the drama painted in much more detail about the First World War that contemporaries called the Great War. It was a shattering experience. It births one ideology after another: fascism in Italy, communism in the wreckage of the Russian Empire. Also, in reaction to the horrors of the First World War, makes a lot of people very enthusiastic for democracy and Woodrow Wilson's ideas as American president, who announces that this is a war that will make the world safe for democracy, a war to end all wars. So, you know, holds out the promise of a democratic world order. When Germany collapses in the fall of 1918, it leaves Germans badly shocked, because in an age where modern propaganda was still so young and effective that we had not collectively yet built up skepticism, or you might say antibodies, to the claims of propaganda, Germans had been told for 4 years that you're suffering, you might be hungering, things are difficult, but Germany is winning. And then in the fall of 1918, everything comes crashing down. Germany, even though it has conquered vast territories in Eastern Europe and seems to be holding the line on the Western Front, sues for peace. The German emperor flees into exile, and Germans suddenly have a new form of government, a democracy that arises without there having been an act of will on the part of the population at large. And so it's something people can choose how to react to. The name Weimar Republic comes from the fact that a constitution is written in the city of Weimar, a city of German poets and playwrights and culture, of Goethe and Schiller. So it was an act of sympathetic magic, right? They wrote the constitution not in war-torn Berlin, in the midst of civil war between different political factions, but in this blessed, culturally gifted spot of Weimar. And the constitution is praised as being the most progressive, the most democratic, the most advanced of any world constitution at the time. It's admired. But people are willing at first in Germany to give democracy a chance, in part because of enthusiasm for how it might lead to a better outcomes. But then the harshness of the Versailles Treaty comes as a blow when Germans expected to be treated as new members in a world community of democracies. There's a lot of hypocrisy on the part of outraged German nationalists who protested against Versailles, because when they were winning, they imposed extremely harsh, even harsher peace treaties on defeated Russia, for instance. But that said, that was an element of bitterness. And then the key question is economic volatility, hyperinflation in 1923, and then Germany's experience of the worldwide Great Depression in the early 1930s. Those things conspire to undermine German confidence in democracy, in spite of significant earlier enthusiasm for it. So historians tend to be at pains to point out collapse was not inevitable. There's nothing predetermined about this. But historians are also at pains to point out one other thing. And I think it makes the kind of the scary lessons that you referred to at the outset even scarier. The Nazis do not overthrow, when they come to power in January of 1933, do not overthrow a functioning, healthy, vigorous democracy. In fact, Germany was no longer a functioning democracy even before the Nazis come to power. The parliament was deadlocked. It was impossible to form governments on a broad basis. The entire system was losing legitimacy in the eyes of ordinary Germans. So in some sense, a lot of people, especially people who were canny political observers, expected not a Nazi takeover, but probably military dictatorship. The Nazis, in some sense, exploit a crisis that was pre-existing and then manage to impose their solutions and to foreclose all other options through a combination of propaganda and violence and then eventually genocide. So in some sense, what was key here was a lack of attachment to democracy that predates the Nazi onslaught. I mean, a terrible paradox is that the Nazis come to power not as a result of a majority vote. They do gain greater and greater support among German voters, but their vote share is actually declining in elections at the point when Hitler manages to be appointed as chancellor. So there's a high degree of contingency. And that makes the situation, I think, in retrospect, even worse rather than explaining it away. A great figure and a controversial thinker who's likely to be read hundreds of years from now, the way the Stoics are read today, was a German Jewish philosopher, political philosopher by the name of Hannah Arendt. Hannah Arendt experienced this. She lived through it. So she was an up-close observer. And in 1951, as a refugee to the United States from Hitler's Germany, she wrote a book called Origins of Totalitarianism. And it's just as big as Democracy in America. It's a great big book. And I've assigned it before to upper level undergraduate classes. In this book, she argued that waves of authoritarian rule in she was comparing Nazi Germany with Stalin's Soviet Union at the time, are forms of government that might have very different ideologies, but they share certain qualities that make them subcategories of a totalitarian state. And she argued that totalitarian movements become so powerful because they combine terror and enthusiasm. They organize loneliness. I think of what a scary term that is, that they organize loneliness by providing answers and a sense of direction to collectively march off into. Hannah Arendt didn't propose that she had all the answers, but one thing that was implicit in her analysis was, if only more people had been not just lukewarm about democracy and lukewarm about their republic, but had been actively committed and dedicated to ensuring its survival and its thriving, the whole story might have been different. And I think you know where this is headed. Hannah Arendt also believed that totalitarianism was not a horrible reversion to primitive models. She feared that it was actually the wave of the future and something that lay ahead for humanity as a whole. And on a day like today, when you walk around campus or any American city, you're likely to see lots of people almost bumping into each other because they're all on their phones. They're walking along, not communicating face to face with one another, but on their phones. And I think that Hannah Arendt would have said, that looks a lot like loneliness. That looks a lot like atomization and alienation. And thus, the raw material for organizing loneliness is still with us, even after particular dictatorships have been defeated or have come crashing down. And that's a really scary prediction for the future.
That is terrifying. But I think a point very well made. And I'd love to spend a little bit of time on the details of how Hitler pulled it off. You talked about the context of the post-World War One lives of ordinary Germans, and that they never received majority support from elections, the economic situation in Germany, but the logistics of how his ascendancy actually occurred. And again, I want to couch this in just more mindfulness and awareness to a modern audience of how these phenomenons actually come to be real in the world. And, you know, I would also love at some point in the conversation to give you time to talk in whatever detail you would like about what you see as a historian now. You just mentioned people being atomized and distracted by their phones. I've done a few episodes about that very fact, the modern loneliness and modern tech addictions.
Yeah.
But anyways, I want to put that to you and give you space in your historical knowledge to speak to that at whatever length you would like as well.
Yeah, this is also a really very complex topic. When the Nazis come to power, they're very open about doing away with the pluralism of democracy and insist that Germany is going to be unitary, with one people, one empire, and one Führer. But this isn't done in a top-down fashion. The process of Nazifying Germany, you might say, in German it's called Gleichschaltung. This is the term that they used, intending it as a revelation of their plan. Gleichschaltung means something like, it's fundamentally untranslatable, but it means something like getting into line or coordinating or making sure there's no outliers, putting everything into line. So it's the imposition of an order. But the scary thing to note about this wasn't achieved by Hitler alone, working from the government quarters in Berlin. To bring an entire society to heel, all of the institutions of government, all the universities, all the organs of the media, required active cooperation from a lot of people, millions of people, in fact. When we talk about the Nazi coordination of German society with students, it's a horrifying thing to have to point out to students that the first institutions that become that eagerly start on this process, even before it's formally ordered, are institutions of higher education in Germany, which had been famous worldwide as top research institutions and kind of the model for what an institution should look like, including for American universities. The student government organizations Nazify themselves earliest, and its faculty, who seek out unreliable or objectionable people in their own ranks, and start setting about this process. So there's a voluntary element to all of this, which is very chastening and honestly very depressing to follow in detail. I think if you step back and ask about the psychological background of all of this, a lot of it has to do with a sense of what is normative. And I think that the Nazis, as well as other anti-democratic movements at the time, Italian fascists under Mussolini, communists under Lenin and Stalin, were insistent and effectively insistent to a lot of people in declaring that the age of democracy was over, that this was a 19th century relic that represented particular interests and had no relevance to the present day. They offered a different vision, an authoritarian vision, one that involved total control, total coordination, total planning. And a lot of this gets summed up in a really horrifying Italian fascist claim about Italy, that the fascists finally made the trains run on time. That's a terrible thing to say about a repressive regime, as if allegedly violence and repression is justified by efficiency and utility. And it's especially objectionable to hear, even in American politics, politicians use the phrase making the trains run on time in kind of blissful ignorance of where that phrase actually comes from. But I think that this was indispensable in the whole psychological mix of people want to identify themselves with the wave of the future rather than to be left behind in the past. And this was especially dispiriting and challenging to have it alleged that democracy and self-rule and consent of the governed is a fossil and is of no relevance. I think that in the dramas of our own lifetimes and the last two generations, we've seen a worldwide struggle over this, with the defeat of Nazi Germany, with the collapse of the Soviet Union, some of those episodes end, but the temptations of people to give up their freedom for other alleged goods is still with us. And as Hannah Arendt would have pointed out, that totalitarian potential or the temptation is also still with us, precisely because it corresponds to aspects of our abiding human nature. It's not just a invasion of unworldly evil from outside. The problem is within. And one witness to the 20th century's struggle over these issues, himself a controversial figure, the Russian dissident Alexander Solzhenitsyn, memorably stated that he'd learned from his experiences in the Gulag prison camps and repression and thinking about the human experience of the 20th century. One thing he'd concluded was, it's not as if the evil ones are they and we are the good, but rather, as he said, the line between good and evil goes right through the human heart. And so there's that potential for both the good and the bad in all of us. And then we come back to the Stoics, right? The Stoics talked about self-mastery and self-awareness. And I think that that's going to be key to a better future if all of us understand this, the potential both for great achievement and for these other horrific dimensions of political malpractice that are with us still and definitely haven't gone away.
Yeah, very well said. And I know we're getting relatively close to the end of our time together today, but I would be remiss if I didn't ask you, as you look around the country and around your campus and around the election that we have coming up here in just a few weeks, where your historian brain goes, what you see in our country in terms of, if any, threats to our own development in these directions. And maybe there are none, and that's not particularly a concern, but I know I wanted to bring that up to you to get, you know, your current historical lens on the threat of totalitarianism, the the zeitgeist in the culture. You mentioned again the atomization and the loneliness, which can be a key component in the development of totalitarianism in a society. What do you see? What if any, and this is mostly about risks to the way of life and the way of government that we inhabit in our nation. How do you think about that in our current context, particularly with this presidential election coming up?
So I think that historical moments that are fraught and that are conflicted, they test societies, right? And they try men's souls. At the same time, as we could present many examples of mutual demonization and of declaring that it's impossible to have dialogue, that it's impossible to talk about first principles or questions of what makes us distinctive as a political project, I'd want to put that pessimism aside and just mention some things that I think actually are grounds for optimism. I think that, one of the great benefits of being on a campus is there's a constant infusion, if you're a professor, a constant infusion of wave after wave of young people who are arriving, who are enthusiastic, who are inquiring, who, as long as it's not too early in the morning, are willing to play along with the notion or the conceit that the class has really important things to say that are relevant to their own lives, and so that youthfulness, I think, which all of us retain in some measure, that gives me hope. When you have debates in class between people of very different political stripes, but who together are working on a project that brings them together, which is to understand modes of thinking that are probably alien to everybody in the class, but trying to reason through to an understanding of what's going on here, how does this all logically cohere if it does, and what are the implications in terms of historical development. That moment, that's really a wonderful moment, because it gives you a model for what other kinds of reasoned, dispassionate, but still committed and sincere dialogue can be like. And so my hope is that we place a lot of hope in education, and I think that's justified. And wouldn't it be wonderful if that sort of model that has been the ideal of universities and colleges could have broader application in our society as a whole, and maybe move us past, beyond some of that division and atomization that we've unfortunately seen so much of.
Yeah, fair enough. And I'd love to close the conversation. I know we talked about this offline, but the great courses, I'd love to give people that are, you know, interested in your expertise and are interested in learning more, where can they go? And if you want to give a little preview about what the great courses really are, you talked earlier about, I think it was the 36 lectures that you've given. What's on store for people that may pursue that? What might be interesting for people there?
Well, thank you. I'm a huge fan of the Great Courses company, even before I was asked to lecture for them, because back in the days of CDs and cassette tapes, there was nothing like driving across the country and not listening to mindless radio, but instead popping in a lecture by a great instructor and being enriched. And so now I really value the opportunity to share some of the history in different courses that I've done for them. These include courses on utopia and terror in the 20th century. It's kind of the century-long collision between different models of ideological rule. A course on the history of diplomacy in European history. A course on explorers and world exploration, which is fantastic fun because of the amazing stories of survival and of disaster, as well as triumph. I've done a course on espionage. Most recently, I completed a three-part course on the history of communism, its rise, communism in power, and then most recently, communism in decline, from Sputnik to Gorbachev, that's just come out with the great courses on DVD and to stream, and also available on Audible. I think that I'm so enthusiastic about the model of these recorded lectures because it's yet another avenue for sharing historical literacy, and most definitely not setting an agenda for what people are supposed to believe or conclude, but to give them the tools, to give them the information, the building blocks, the conceptual framework for coming to their own conclusions about what developments in modernity broadly are healthy and which ones are questionable, in essence, to draw their own conclusions. And that can be done in those great big tomes that we talked about, like Tocqueville or Hannah Arendt. It can be done in marvelous podcasts like your own, and also in these recorded lecture series that one can just watch and listen to at one's own pace as the busy day allows. So thank you for allowing me to share that.
Absolutely. I think you and I have similar cross-country road trip tendencies. I love that stuff too. Vejas, this was such an honor to do this. Thank you so much for giving me the time, giving the audience the time. It was a real pleasure. So thank you, man.
Thank you. It was a great conversation. Enjoyed it.